For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We're going to be looking at Hebrews 11, verse 20 through 22, and we're going to be looking at the patriarchs, which are the 12 sons of Israel, a.k.a. Jacob. Why don't we read our passage first? Well, actually, let's start back in verse 1 of Hebrews 11 so we don't sort of lose our place and forget what this is all about. The author of Hebrews says, "Now faith is the beginning of being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see." So faith is not wishful thinking. It's not creative thinking where we just use mind control to envision things that are good happening and hope that they will happen. But there's an assurance, there is a certainty of what it is that we're putting our faith into. And he says that it's what we hope for and a certainty of what we do not see. And so that's been a theme that's sort of woven throughout all of chapter 11, is this idea of what is seen, which is typically our current circumstances, what we see with our own eyes. But what is often unseen is what God is doing. And that usually gets revealed over some time, as we've seen in some of these examples of faith in the Old Testament. Okay, let's look at our passage then. Verses 20 and 21. "By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on top of his staff." So he brings up Jacob and Esau. These are sons of Isaac. If you can remember last week, we talked about Isaac, who was the son of the promise. He was the son of Abraham. And the author of Hebrews quickly moves over Isaac's life. I'm sure there were a lot of really interesting things about his life, but moves on to Jacob and Esau, the sons of Isaac. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because it comes up later on in the book of Hebrews. We're going to talk about the relationship between Esau and Jacob. We want to move on to verse 22, where he says, "By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones." Okay, so this is a reference to Genesis chapter 50, where at the end of Joseph's life, we're told that he said to his brothers, he says, "You know, I want you to make sure that when God rescues us out of this land of Egypt, that you make sure to take my bones, because I'll be long dead by then, and I want you to take it to the promised land." Because if we can remember last week, Abraham was promised by God this incredible land, which would be an inheritance for him. And so Joseph, we're told, was looking forward to this. Now I want to spend a little bit of time looking at Joseph's life. Actually, not a little bit of time, the rest of our time. So probably about 40 minutes talking about Joseph. And we're going to be flying through this narrative because we're going to cover about 8 chapters. And I'm going to skip through certain sections and sort of narrate it. But, you know, as we go through this, I'm sure some of you are wondering, okay, why are we like coming to a crawl when we are going through Hebrews 11? I think one of the reasons why we're doing this is because it's a unique chapter, because you can actually make your way through the Old Testament and sort of get a broad narrative of the Old Testament, which otherwise would be very difficult to do. And so I want to kind of press on here and maybe study a few more figures before we move on to chapter 12. Okay. Now let's move on here to Joseph. Okay. Starting in Genesis chapter 37, verse 3, we're told, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age." Joseph was one of the 12 sons born to Jacob. These later became the 12 tribes of Israel. And we're told that Israel, which is, you know, another name for Jacob, loved Joseph. And the reason that he loved him was because he was born to him in his old age. And to signify this, he made Joseph this incredibly richly ornamented robe. You know, think about how some of us grew up in families with siblings. Jealousy and envy is sort of a part of the dynamic of the family. You know, in this case, Joseph would walk through the door and Jacob, you know, his eyes would light up. He knew all of Joseph's friends. He knew his teachers. He knew all about, you know, how he was doing in school. And then the other 11 brothers would roll in. He could barely remember their names. And so they, I'm sure, were acutely aware of this. They sensed that Jacob loved Joseph more than them, as most siblings can detect. And to sort of signify this, Jacob makes Joseph this incredibly ornate robe. In Hebrew, some of the cognates for this word, richly ornamented, means long sleeves, which is kind of weird. I'm not sure that's really the right translation of the word. In the Greek translation of the Old Testament, it says many colors. That's where we get this idea that the robe was multicolored. And this multicolored robe was sort of like a way of obviously demonstrating his favoritism for Joseph. You know, so one day it's Christmas time and, you know, he shows up, you know, with this nice coat for Joseph, you know, it's from Nordstrom's. And then, you know, all the other 11 brothers, you know, are opening up their package. They get a coat too, and it's, you know, from the sales shelf at Kmart. You know, they're sitting over there looking at their coats and looking at Joseph's, just like, man. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not even speak a kind word to him. And so this envy really transformed into hatred, so much so that they couldn't even speak a kind word to him. You know how that is when you're like so angry at somebody, so bitter toward them, you can't even say a kind word to them. And then we're told that Joseph has a dream that sort of makes things a little bit worse. He has this dream, and so he quickly runs to his brothers, and he's like, man, I had this incredible dream. We were out in the field gathering these bundles of grain, and my bundle of grain, which was really big, stood up, and all of your bundles of grain bowed down to mine. You're like, what do you think that means? And of course, you know, the brothers just hated him all the more. They're saying, so you think you're going to rule over us? You think we're going to both bow down to you? Joseph has another dream sometime later. This time, you know, he rounds up his dad and his brothers. And he's like, man, I had another one of those incredible dreams. He says, I was standing there and the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. And, you know, Jacob was indignant about this. He was angry. He said, so you think that me and your mother and your brothers are going to worship you? And he's like, I'm just telling you about my dream. And but we're told in the narrative that Jacob wondered about these things that he was saying. Well, one day, the brothers are out tending the flock, and Joseph, of course, is with his dad. He makes all the other kids go out and work while Joseph gets to play and hang out at the house. And he says, why don't you go check on your brothers out in the field? And so he makes his way to go see his brothers. And we're told in Genesis 37, verse 18 through 20, that they saw him in the distance. Now, here's a question. How could they tell that this was Joseph? It's because he's wearing that multicolored robe, right? And before he reached them, he plotted to kill him. And so their envy had transformed into hatred, which then gave birth to a murderous rage. And so they plotted to kill him. They said, here comes that dreamer. You know, this is typical of hatred toward people. You know, when you're so bitter at somebody, you can't even see straight. And what you do is, in many different ways, you try to dehumanize that person. One way you do that is you can't even talk about them. You can't even say their name because you hate them so much. Instead, you got to call them that dreamer, daddy's favorite little boy. Well, they said, come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal actually devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. And Reuben, the oldest, stopped him. He said, we can't do this. We can't kill him. Instead, why don't we just beat him up a little bit, throw him into a cistern. And so they laid hands on him, beat him, stripped him of that multicolored robe that Jacob loved so much, threw him down into the cistern. And then incredibly, we're told in verse 25 that they sat down to have a meal. I mean, imagine the callousness, the remorselessness, you know, to just sit there. It's almost like you committed a murder, and on the seat of the crime, you're like, you know what, I'm a little hungry. And so you sit down and actually have a meal. So then when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. And so as they're sitting there having a meal, they see this caravan passing by. And they say, you know, let's just turn a quick profit off of this guy. And so they pull him out of the cistern. And we're told that they pay 20 shekels for him. Now, this is actually interesting because in the book of Hosea, we're told that when Hosea marries his wife, who happens to be an adulteress, known to be unfaithful, Gomer, as she's called. Sounds adulterous, right? I mean, Gomer. We're told that when God said, I want you to go and buy back Gomer, because she at some point had left him and got enslaved, that when he went to purchase her at the auction block, that he paid 30 shekels of silver, which we know in the ancient world was sort of the going rate for slaves. And so they're like, you know, he's not even worth 20 shekels of silver. Let's just give him, let's get that amount and just send him off, get rid of him. And then they took the ornamented robe back to their father and said, we found this, examine it to see whether it's your son's robe. What they did was they took a goat and they slaughtered the goat and took some of the blood and wiped it onto the robe and dipped the robe into it and made up this lie, this fabricated this lie that he had been mauled by an animal. Well, Jacob recognized it and said, it's my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and mourned for his son for many days, which was a typical custom of near ancient or near Eastern mourning. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. He was inconsolable about what happened here. Now, there's sort of a terrible irony to this whole story, if you're familiar with the book of Genesis. You know, Jacob's dad had his own favorite son, and it wasn't him. You know, Jacob had a brother Esau, as we read earlier in Hebrews, and Esau was the older son. He was kind of a manly man. He was hairy. He was a hunter. You know, he was just a big tough guy. Whenever he would fart, you know, lightning bolts would come out of his butt. He's smelled like, you know, leather and sandalwood. But Jacob, you know, he had real smooth skin. He was kind of like a Nivea lotion model. And, you know, he wasn't really an outdoorsman. He really liked to hang out in the tents. He probably was into cooking. He hung out with the women. And so we're told that Isaac, his father, actually loved Esau more. Also, you know, we're told that Jacob, Jacob falls right into this same pattern himself. You know, when he marries these two women, Rachel and Leah, we're told that he loves Rachel more. In Genesis 29, verse 18 through and 20, we're told that when he saw Leah, the author of Genesis describes Leah as having weak eyes, but Rachel, she was beautiful both in form and face. And Jacob loved Rachel. Now, this idea of having weak eyes, most people think it's a euphemism for something. You know, she had a, I don't know, unconventional look, so to speak. She was, you know, handsome woman. And so, but Rachel, though, we're told on the other hand that she was beautiful both in form and face. She had a nice figure, nice face. And, you know, it turns out that Joseph was Rachel's son. She had two sons, and Jacob actually favored Rachel's sons because he loved her more. And it's interesting, too, because, you know, in the narrative there of Jacob, Jacob manages to steal Esau's birthright. He creates this twisted plot or this twisted scheme where he decides as his father's getting older and his eyesight is flagging that he's going to actually take some of his brother's clothes and he's going to rub it on himself so he smells like leather and, you know, sandalwood, and that he's actually going to put, you know, goat hair over his body so that when his father touches his skin, it seems like it's Esau. I guess, you know, whenever Esau took off his shirt, he looked like he had a merino wool sweater on or something like that. And so he was able to deceive his father, Isaac, and was able to steal the birthright. And so it's interesting and sort of ironic that his other sons, you know, Jacob's sons, take a goat and their brother's clothes and they deceive their father, Jacob, just like he did with Isaac. And so we see that there's this pattern, this cycle, you know, which is, I think, something that resonates with us. You know, a lot of times we grow up in a certain household where things are the way they are, and we critique it, we don't like it, we try to fight against it, and then as we grow older, we start to see ourselves following the same pattern. It's very interesting. Well, anyway, Joseph's brothers sold him to this Midianite caravan passing by. And sometime later, we're told that when they arrive in Egypt, that they sell Joseph to this wealthy man named Potiphar. And we're told in Genesis 39, verse 2, that the Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered and lived in the house of his Egyptian master. This guy Potiphar was, you know, a top-ranking official in Egypt. And, you know, he gets sold to this guy. But we're told something really interesting, that the Lord was with Joseph. You know, even though he had been betrayed by his brothers, even though he had been beaten by them, sold as a slave for a cut rate, that the Lord was still with him. And we're also told that he prospered as well. You know, this is where he began his meteoric rise in Potiphar's household and actually became the one who was in charge of his entire household. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household and he entrusted to his care everything that he owned. You know, imagine that. This guy shows up, he's sold as a slave, and he's so able, so capable, charismatic, sharp, probably brilliant, that he's like, you know, I can trust this guy. I'm going to give him everything that I own and he can manage it. And from the time he put him in charge of the household and all of he owned, the Lord actually blessed his household because of Joseph. And so he left in Joseph's care everything that he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not even concern himself with anything except the food that he ate. Imagine that. He's like, look, I'm just going to sit here with this food and you can do whatever, okay? Take care of me. Now, we're also told that Joseph was well-built and handsome. Wow. So, you know, it turns out Joseph was not only really smart, really capable, really gifted, had a lot of integrity. We're told that he was hot. He was well-built and handsome. You know, he had a nice prominent jawline, probably. Nice-looking skin. And so Joseph had it going on. You know, Joseph had come a long way from the empty cistern, and really the future looked bright for this well-built and handsome young man. But then we're told after a while his master's wife took notice of him, Potiphar's wife. The Hebrew literally means lifted her eyes toward, which emphasizes the deliberate and careful scrutiny of Joseph. You know, so Joseph's walking through the hall and Potiphar's wife looks at him, kind of gives him the look up and down, checks him out. And, you know, it's just like, man, he's a hot little beefcake. And so she propositions him in not so subtle way. She says, come to bed with me. You know, she's a woman of power. She's probably used to getting what she wants. And think about this from Joseph's standpoint too. You know, a lot of times when you're successful, when it feels like everything you touch turns to gold, it's really easy, I think, to get addicted to success. There's a thrill of accomplishing, of conquering. And it would have been really easy for Joseph to have just taken this opportunity. This would have been yet another conquest for him. And yet, we're told that something was different about Joseph. And his answer to her was very clear. He refused her. He said no. We're told, my master has withheld everything from me except for you because you are his wife. And how could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? Joseph had integrity. He's like, my master, he took care of me. He took me from being a slave to managing his entire household. How could I betray him by doing that? More importantly, how could I betray God? That's amazing considering all that he had gone through, all of the suffering that he experienced to hold on to his integrity with God. And, you know, a lot of times you see people go through immense trial in their life, severe trial. And for them, it's a justification to say, why should I even follow God? He's not worth it. And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even to be with her. And so he cut her off. He said, you know what? Even though you're continually pursuing me, I'm not gonna betray God or my master. Well, in 39, verse 11 through 15, we're told one day he went into the house to attend to his duties and none of the household servants were inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. Turns out she didn't have a different line. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. She called her household servants. Look, this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us or to embarrass us. And so here Joseph is accused of this crime, trying to rape Potiphar's wife. And he knows what's going to happen. He knows that Potiphar is going to have to defend his wife, even though he may not believe her. After all, he's just a Hebrew slave. Is he going to throw her under the bus for him? No way. You know, we're told that Potiphar burned with anger and threw Joseph into prison. When you look at Joseph's life, really it's just filled with ups and downs, isn't it? It's sort of a roller coaster. You know, one day he's dad's favored son. The next moment he's thrown into this dark cistern, enslaved in Egypt. He rises to the top of the ranks in Potiphar's household, and then the next moment he's thrown into prison. It must have been really confusing, especially as a follower of God. You may have been wondering himself, where is God? Have I just wasted my time holding on to my integrity? I've tried to be faithful and this is what he gives me? Now, some of you are here right now, struggling, suffering. Some sort of circumstance has befallen you. And you're asking maybe the same questions that Joseph was asking himself. How could this happen to me? I've been living for God. But while Joseph was in there in the prison, the Lord was with him. It's interesting, you know, the Lord enters into this narrative always at the deepest, sort of darkest times of Joseph's life. You know, we're told God showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden so that the warden put Joseph in charge of all that those held in prison. And he was made responsible for all that was done there. So it's just like whatever he touched turned to gold. I mean, wherever he was at, it was just he would prosper. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. You know, in prison, Joseph meets Pharaoh's cupbearer and chief baker. These guys were accused of some sort of crime. We're not told in the narrative. And Joseph is, you know, going around attending to the other prisoners. And he sees Pharaoh's cupbearer and chief baker just sort of sitting there on the bench. And they're looking real sad. And so for a moment, he sets aside his own problems. You know, he's got a ton of his own. Sitting there on trial for a crime he didn't commit with probably no possibility of getting out. He's like, but you know what? I'm just going to set that aside for now and just see what's going on with these guys. And so he sits down, says, what's wrong? And, you know, they explain the situation. And they say, well, you know, by the way, we both had these dreams and we're sort of puzzled by it. And Joseph's like, oh, that's interesting because I can actually interpret dreams. And so the cupbearer tells him his dream, and so does the chief baker. And so he turns to the cupbearer and he says, okay, here's the interpretation of your dream. Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you back to your position of prominence. You're going to be his cupbearer again. And he's like, oh, that's awesome. When I get out of here, if that's true, I'm going to make sure to remember you, see if I can get you out of here. And the chief baker's like, well, what about me? He said, in your case, Pharaoh's going to lift your head right off of your body. And he's going to stick your dead corpse on a pole. And the chief baker's like, that's the last time I tell you about one of my dreams. Well, everything happens just like Joseph says. But we're told that the cupbearer actually forgets about Joseph. He goes on with his life. In Genesis 41, verse 1, 2 full years pass at this time. You know, try to think about what kind of struggles Joseph must have been wrestling through in his mind. Being here, rotting in prison for 2 years on these trumped up charges. You know, he might have been feeling despair. Nothing is ever going to change, you know. Every time I get into a position where it seems like things are getting better, it always gets worse. every single time. He might have experienced unbelief. He might have been angry at God. Why are you doing this to me? Have I done something wrong? Are you trying to punish me through this? This is some sort of sick joke, right? Maybe he felt hate and bitterness toward God. You're the one who put me here. After all I've done for you? After holding on to my faith? He might have felt cynicism. You know, he might experience some blessing, but he knows that every time he gets a blessing from God, he can't relax and enjoy it because he knows that at some point, God's probably going to take it away from him again. And so even though God may bless him, it just doesn't sit right with him. He's waiting for the other foot to fall. You know, by giving into these feelings, Joseph would have been grasping on to what was seen. You know, just like what the author of Hebrews was talking about in Hebrews 11, verse 1, that faith is having certainty of what is unseen. You know, when you look at the situation that Joseph was in, it would be easy to fall into any one of those attitudes. And yet it's clear that God wasn't done in this situation. In verse 2 through 4, we're told Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing by the Nile when out of the river there came out seven cows, sleek and fat, and they were grazing among the reeds. After them, seven other cows, ugly and gaunt, came out of the Nile and stood beside those on the riverbank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the seven fat, sleek cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. Whoa. That must have been real vivid. So, you know, Pharaoh, he says, I want to know what this dream means. And so he calls all the wise men from around Egypt, tries to pull them in, and he tells them what the dream is, but none of them can interpret it. Then we're told in verse 9, the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, today I'm reminded of my failures. He's like, there's this guy, his name is Joseph. I remember that when I was in a prison because of that, you know, thing that happened. He was able to actually interpret one of my dreams. And so maybe he can help out here. So in verse 14, we're told Pharaoh sent for Joseph and he was quickly brought from the dungeon. And when he had shaved and changed his clothes, he came before Pharaoh. It's kind of weird. Shaved. You know, he didn't shave in the sense that we think of. He got an Egyptian, which is where you get all hair on your body shaved off. Apparently, the Egyptians really hated hair. They hated animals that had hair. And so in order for him to come into the presence of Pharaoh, he actually needed to shave everything. I'm talking about his head, his eyebrows. I don't know if you've ever seen hieroglyphics and stuff or pictures of it, depictions. A lot of times they would shave the Egyptian's face and, you know, apply makeup over their eyebrows or whatever. And so that's probably what they did to Joseph to make him look like an Egyptian. Well, Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream and no one can interpret it. But I've heard that it's said that you can, when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. I cannot do it, Joseph replied to Pharaoh, but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. See, this could have been an opportunity for Joseph to have betrayed God, to take credit and to say, you know what, I could do this. And yet he gives glory to God, even though he spent 2 years in prison suffering. He didn't let go of his faith. So Pharaoh describes his dream to Joseph. And then Joseph said to Pharaoh, God has revealed to Pharaoh what he's about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years. The seven lean, ugly cows, those are 7 years also. They're going to be 7 years of famine. God showed Pharaoh what he's about to do. 7 years of great abundance are coming throughout the land of Egypt, but 7 years of famine will follow them. The abundance in the land will not be remembered because the famine that follows will be so severe. And so Joseph says, you know, what you need to do is you need to save up grain from the first 7 years of abundance. That way you can make it, all of Egypt can make it through the 7 years of famine. And so Pharaoh and his council said, what are we going to do? Who are we going to appoint for this incredible task? We need to find somebody who is capable, somebody who is wise, somebody who is well-built, handsome. And so they pick Joseph. He says, you know, who is wiser than you? You're the only one who is able to actually interpret my dream. And so God catapults Joseph to second in command to the most powerful nation on earth. This is amazing. You know, he says, pretty much the only person who's going to be more powerful than you is me. And I'm going to be busy. So you can take care of all of Egypt. That's incredible. Imagine that. 1 minute you're sitting in a dungeon rotting with no hope of ever getting out, to the next moment being the second most powerful person on earth. That'd be like, you know, stuck in the county jail one day and then, you know, being brought into the White House and you replace Joe Biden. That's what this would be like. Well, meanwhile, back in Canaan, when Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, why do you just keep looking at each other? He's like, aren't you hungry? You guys are just staring at each other. He says, go down there to Egypt and buy some grain for us so that we can live and not die. Now, Joseph was the governor of the land, the one who sold grain to all his people. So when Joseph's brother arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. Remember the dream? As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them. You know, again, imagine what that would have been like. You know, 21 years since he had seen his brothers. 21 years. The guys who landed him in prison, who landed him in slavery. I'm sure there were nights when he was in prison, when he was probably scrubbing Potiphar's floor, where he was fantasizing about this moment right here. What would I say to them if I saw him again? What would I do? And this time he actually had, he could do something about it. At that moment, he could have thrown them in prison or execute them on the spot. And yet Joseph didn't see things from a purely horizontal point of view. He could have enacted his vengeance right then and there. You know, a lot of times when we're suffering, we think that it's circumstance that's against us. Often we think it's people who are against us. When in reality, God is actually doing something much bigger that we just can't even see. And so Joseph knew that God was at work. That if he had gotten him to this point in his life, despite all the ups and downs, that he would get him through this. Well, he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. He says, where do you guys come from? From the land of Canaan, they replied, to buy food. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they didn't recognize him, probably because he was in his Egyptian garb. Then he remembered his dreams about them and said to them, you're spies! You've come to see where our land is and that it's unprotected. No, my lord, they answered. Your servants have come to buy food. We're all sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies. I'm sure Joseph was like, I know you guys aren't honest men. No, he said to them, you have come to see that our land is unprotected. I'm sure of it. But they replied, your servants were 12 brothers, the son of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father and one is no more. They didn't care to elaborate on that. Joseph said to them, you're spies and this is how you'll be tested. You will not leave this place unless your youngest brother who was left behind comes here. Send one of your number to go get your brother and the rest of you are going to be kept in prison. And he put them in custody for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, do this and you'll live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you and go take grain back to your starving household. And so he fills up their sacks with grain to bring back to Jacob. But you must bring your youngest brother back to me so that your words may be verified and that you may not die. This they proceeded to do. They said to one another, surely we're being punished because of our brother Joseph. We saw how distressed he was, when he pleaded with us for his life, but we wouldn't even listen to him. That's why this distress has come upon us. Reuben replied, didn't I tell you not to sin against this boy? But you guys wouldn't even listen. Now we must have to give an account for his blood. They didn't realize that Joseph could understand them since he was using an interpreter. He heard the whole play-by-play. He turned away from them and began to weep, but then turned back and spoke to them again. And so he had Simeon taken before them and bound. Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain, to put each man's silver back into his sack, and to give them provisions for their journey. After this was done for them, they loaded their grain on their donkeys and left. At the place where they stopped for the night, one of them opened the sack to get the feed from the donkey, and he saw that there was silver at the mouth of the sack. My silver's been returned, he said to his brothers. It's right here, my sack. Their hearts sank, and they turned to each other trembling and said, what is it that God has done to us? You know, they were probably thinking to themselves, how could we ever return back to Egypt? He's going to think that we stole this. Well, the remaining brothers reported everything back to Jacob. And we're told later on, sometime later, in 43, verse 1 through 7, the famine was still severe in the land. So when they had eaten all the grain that they had brought from Egypt, their father said to them, go back and buy us a little bit more food. But Judah said to him, the man warned us solemnly, you will not see my face again unless your brother is with you. If you will send our brother along with us, we will go down and buy your food for you. You know, when they first recounted the story to Jacob, Jacob's like, no way. I already lost Joseph, the other one of my sons from Rachel. I'm not going to give Benjamin away. And so he refused. And so this time, the brothers are pleading with him. They're like, we're going to starve to death. All of us are going to die if you don't send Benjamin. He says, but if you do not send him, we will not go down, because the man said to us, you will not see our face again unless your brother's with you. Israel asked, why did you bring this trouble on me by telling the man that you had another brother? They replied, the man questioned us closely about ourselves and our family, asking things like, is your father still living? Do you have any other brothers? We simply answered his questions. How were we to know that he was going to say, bring your brother down here? Good point. Jacob said, okay, may God Almighty grant you mercy before the man so that he will let you, your other brother, and Benjamin come back to you. As for me, I am bereaved. If I'm bereaved, I'm bereaved. If I have to suffer, I'm going to suffer. And so he sends those guys down. Now, when Joseph saw Benjamin with them as they're approaching, he said to the stewards of the house, take these men to my house, slaughter an animal, and prepare dinner. They're to eat with me at noon. Now, the men were frightened when they were taken to his house. They thought, we were brought here because of the silver that was put into our sacks the first time. After all, they were only there to get some grain. And now Joseph, the second in command in all of Egypt, calls all of the brothers back to his house. They said to themselves, he wants to attack us and overpower us and seize us as slaves and take our donkeys. Yeah, I'm sure that's his motivation, taking your donkeys. When Joseph came home, they presented to him the gifts they had brought into the house, and they bowed down before him to the ground. He asked them how they were, and then he said, how's your aged father? You told me about. Is he still living? They replied, your servant, our father, is still alive and well, and they bowed down low to pay him honor. Again, they bowed down just like the dream. As he looked about and saw his brother Benjamin, his own mother's son, he asked, is this your youngest brother, the one that you told me about? And he said, God be gracious to you, my son. Deeply moved at the sight of his brother, Joseph hurried out and looked for a place to weep. He went into his private room and wept there. After he had washed his face, he came out and controlled himself. And he said, okay, serve the food. They served him by himself, the brothers by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with them by themselves, because Egyptians don't eat with Hebrews, for that's detestable to the Egyptians. The men who had been seated before them in order of ages, from the firstborn to the youngest, and they looked at each other in astonishment. How did he know? When portions were served to them from Joseph's table, Benjamin's portion was 5 times as much as anyone else's. And he was the smallest, you know, he was the youngest. They're sitting there like, okay, how is it that we're all seated in order of age, and then Benjamin gets supersized? Now, Joseph gave these instructions as they were leaving. Fill the men's sacks with as much food as they can carry and put each man's silver in the mouth of the sack. Then put my cup, the silver one, in the mouth of the youngest one's sack along with the silver for his grain. So he sends them off, and immediately Joseph sends some of his lackeys to go and stop them and search them. And so they stop the brothers as they're leaving to go back to Canaan, and they're like, wait a minute. We think you've stolen something. And immediately the brothers are like, no way, we didn't steal anything. They're like, if we stole anything, let that person who's caught stealing die and the rest of us can be in prison. And so they gave up their sacks and they started searching it. And they looked and found that in Benjamin's sack was Joseph's silver cup. And so they seized him, brought him back to Egypt and threw them down on the ground in the presence of Joseph. Joseph said to them, the man who was found to have the cup will be my slave. The rest of you, you can go back to your father in peace. Judah speaks up. He says, your servant guaranteed the boy's safety to my father. I said, if I do not bring him back to you, I'll bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. You know, this is an interesting, I think, test. And really, I think a brilliant test on Joseph's part. He sets Benjamin up because he knows that Benjamin is the favorite. And this was another opportunity for the brothers to betray their brother. This time, they didn't have to really do anything. They didn't have to throw him into a cistern. They didn't have to sell him. They didn't have to kill him. And they could easily get rid of Jacob's most favorite son at that time. And so Joseph was giving them an opportunity to change, to turn around. Well, Judah says, now then, please let your servant remain here as the Lord's slave in the place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. Judah steps up to the plate on behalf of all the brothers and decides, I'll lay down my life for him. I'll put myself in prison instead of him. And ironically, interestingly, this Judah ends up becoming the family through which the kings of Israel come from. The line where the chosen one of God would eventually come from. And like his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, there would be one from his line who would actually sacrifice himself for others as well. That man was Jesus Christ. And so we get a glimpse here, I think, of this idea of substitution. Maybe one of the earliest pictures of it in the Bible. Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all of his attendants, and he cried out, "Have everyone leave my presence." So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And so he wept loudly so that even the Egyptians heard him. The charade was over. He was satisfied that they really had changed. And so Joseph said to his brothers, he says, I am Joseph. Is my father still living? But his brothers were not even able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." When they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one that you sold into Egypt. And now don't be distressed. Don't be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was God who saves lives that sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there's not going to be any plowing or reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve you for a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God himself." What an incredible perspective. It must have become real clear when his brothers showed up the first time what God was doing. This is reiterated at the end of Joseph's life as he's talking to his brothers. Jacob had died. In chapter 50, verse 20, we're told, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." You know, some of us are experiencing incredible suffering right now, even betrayal. And yet look at the perspective that Joseph had. Even though those people intended harm, God used it for good. And that's the way it is when you grasp on to what's unseen. If you hold on to your faith amid suffering, God can use it in incredible ways. He says, "Now hurry back to my father and say to him, 'This is what your son Joseph said. God has made me Lord of all of Egypt. Come down to me, don't delay. You shall live in the land of Goshen and be near me, and I will provide for you there.'" Now in the aftermath, we're told that Pharaoh actually relocated them to the most fertile land in all of Egypt, the choicest area in Goshen. Just the kind of thing you probably would need if you're going to try to grow a family and into an entire nation. And we're told that God multiplied them for hundreds of years into this incredibly large nation living and thriving in Egypt. Not to mention, the Egyptians avoided them because they were herdsmen. The Egyptians were averse to being around animals and hairy people. And so the Egyptians left them alone. Perfect for what God was trying to do. Let's draw some conclusions. I think the first conclusion we can arrive at is it wasn't that it was difficult to see the outcome of this story from Joseph's perspective. It was impossible to see it. Let me just say that again. It wasn't just difficult for him to see it. It was impossible for him to see it. And you know, for some of us, we are just living day to day because we're suffering. Suffering with some sort of grief in our lives. Suffering through some sort of trial. All we can see is that that we can put our next foot in front of us, and that's about it. And we try to imagine, how could God ever use something so tragic like this? How could God use something so terrible like this? And it would be impossible for us to answer that. And yet many decades later, maybe at the end of our lives, maybe after we're long gone and with the Lord, we'll be able to look back. And I'm certain if we grasp onto what's unseen, our faith, we're going to be amazed and we're going to be able to say, you know what? That was just temporary and momentary affliction. I'd do it all over again in light of what God has done through it. Secondly, God can redeem even the worst of circumstances, betrayals, and suffering. He did that in Joseph's life. We have many people probably in this room who've suffered tremendously and can probably get up here right now and tell you the same thing. I've been through tragedy in my life, and yet God has used it incredibly. Hold on. Don't lose it. Don't abandon God. That's what they would tell you. Some of us are thinking about quitting. Just like the Hebrew audience who's under tremendous persecution, who's under tremendous pressure to quit. No wonder the author of Hebrews is pointing to the life of Joseph. What better way to illustrate perseverance through suffering than Joseph? Also, Joseph was able to maintain his integrity because he didn't lose sight of what God was doing. He didn't just see things from a horizontal point of view. Some of us are locked in that grid where all we can see are the people and the things that are holding us back from what we want. We need to take our eyes off of that and look upward and see that God is at work in this situation, that he may have a bigger plan in view. And he looked forward to God's unseen promise, namely that God would one day take them from the land of Egypt and into the promised land. He was looking back at Abraham's promise that God gave to him and looking forward to his fulfillment of it. And so that's why the author of Hebrews tells us that Joseph was not satisfied to be buried in Egypt, but asked that his bones be brought into the promised land once they left, which happened to be hundreds of years later. So the next step for us, I think, for those of you who don't have a relationship with God, I'd urge you to forge one with him. He's the kind of God who can overcome and use the worst kind of circumstances in your life. You know what's worse than suffering in this life? Suffering and not knowing what use it's really going to have. That's worse than suffering. Meaningless suffering. And yet God says that he can redeem the worst kind of suffering. And he did that through his son Jesus. The Bible teaches that God took on human flesh in the man Jesus and came and died the worst kind of death, the most horrendous kind of death, and through that was able to redeem the entire human race. God purchased your life, your salvation, through his son Jesus. And it'd be a shame for you to say no to his offer to give you that incredible gift. Secondly, if you're here tonight and you're suffering, I think you need to grasp on to that which is unseen and to see how God's going to use that to do something amazing, not only in your life, but in other people's lives as well. Why don't we leave a few minutes here for some prayer. Thanks that your written word actually is relevant to our lives. It's amazing that a story that happened, I don't know, 1,800 years ago or maybe even 1,900 years ago is still relevant today. And the reason why it's relevant is because we know it's from you, that you're a God who speaks to us, God who communicates your love and your mercy to us, even though we don't deserve it. And we thank you for Joseph's example, his life. We thank, you know, Joseph for going through what he did in order to be an example for us, Lord. And we thank you that you captured a story like this for us so that we can be encouraged today. That many of us, you know, either have experienced suffering, are currently going through suffering, or certainly will go through suffering in the future. And we can always look back to passages like this or stories like Joseph and realize that you're a God who can work through even the worst kind of circumstance. And so we thank you for that. I pray especially for those of us, Lord, who don't know you personally, who agonize and suffer and just really can't find any meaning in it. I pray that they would turn to you and allow you to start working in their lives. So I pray for anyone who doesn't know you that they would just receive the forgiveness that you freely offer through your son, Jesus. Thank you for anyone who did that in his name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.